Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. There haven't been many positive stories to tell recently about violence involving police and African Americans. Stories of white cops shooting black men in Louisiana and Minnesota last week were overtaken by the sniper shooting deaths of five white cops by a black man in Dallas in apparent retaliation. That was followed in Baldwin at week's end when a white cop was shot by a black man after a traffic stop. All of this is the latest chapter in the often violent interaction between police and the African-American community. Joining me in studio to talk about the state of policing in this charged atmosphere are Dan Isom, former St. Louis police chief and currently the endowed professor in policing and the community at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Also with us is his colleague in UMSL's criminology department, Dave Klinger. He is the author of Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force. He's a former L.A. police officer who once used deadly force against a man attempting to stab a fellow officer. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Let me ask you about your reaction to yesterday's memorial ceremony in Dallas. Dan Isom, I'll start with you. Did you hear anything there that would indicate to you that things are likely to change or on the verge of changing?
Well, I think the president's remarks about how difficult the job of policing is match with the sense in the African-American community that sometimes they are targeted by police officers is a message that we heard over and over again. And although it might give more people a view of the situation we're faced with, it doesn't really provide any real solutions to how to move forward. And so I thought the president's remarks were on point. The Dallas police chief has given a lot of wisdom to everyone in America about what we need to do. But it's really more about action, and it's more about trust.
Dave Clair, your thoughts?
Yeah, I wish the president would have focused on the tragedy at hand, and that was he was there to memorialize five dead police officers and would have left it at that. There's many other platforms to talk about the broader issues of the racial divide that we need to address.
Let's talk for a moment about the Dallas police chief, Chief Brown. He said something that hasn't been said that often in public, and that is that we're asking police officers to do too much, that there's too much strain. If you've got a barking dog next door, you call a police officer. If the guy next door is beating his wife, you call a police officer, and everything in between. Dan Isom, do you agree with that?
Well, I understand where he's coming from as the police chief of a major city. We were often challenged by not having enough resources to deal with all the demands that society places on police officers. And in particular, when we talk about community policing is a time-intensive effort. When you want people to sit down and make strong relationships with the community, you need more officers to do that, and officers need time to be able to form those relationships. But, you know, when you're answering calls and you're dealing with violence and all the other things that officers need to do, it makes the job of connecting with the community much more difficult.
Dave Clair?
Yeah, I think that the police have become the government entity of last resort for everything, as you pointed out, from a barking dog to perhaps some type of criminal activity with someone beating a family member. And certainly the police need to be involved in a lot of the stuff they're involved in, but we need a different approach. For example, community mental health. Why the police are the point entity to come to the aid of someone who's having a psychotic episode or some type of other thing, no matter how well trained the police are, they're not mental health experts. There are other people that have that real expertise. And so there's a good example of a situation where if we could figure out a way to get mental health workers to the scene with the police and the police are a support or a backup for that, then the mental health worker can work things. What happens, unfortunately, too many times when people are in mental emotional distress is the police get there and the police are the lead entity and the person behaves in a fashion that's threatening and the police are trained to protect themselves and others on the scene and it might devolve to a use of force or even a shooting. And so there's an example of a situation where our society needs to think holistically about how are we going to get services to people in crisis.
Well, the word crisis was one I was just about to use, because some departments do use crisis intervention teams doing the kinds of thing you're talking about here, and have been used fairly effectively. They have people who are well-trained. They can recognize someone who has a mental problem or is on drugs or what have you. Instead of sending them to a jail, they send them to a facility that is prepared to treat them.
Right. And
do we have that in St. Louis, by the way? Do we have a crisis intervention
team? We have a version of that. My argument is that the police should largely be decoupled from that. And what I mean by that is the police show up as support, as I indicated, but someone whose sole job is to deal with people who are in a mental health crisis should be the first responder, and the police should be in the background. The reason the police need to be there is because, unfortunately, some number of these people do have a propensity towards violence, and the police need to be there to protect the mental health worker. But one of the things that we've seen time and time again that leads to bad shootings is the police show up, someone is in a mental health crisis, an emotional crisis, and the police really don't have that expertise. And even if they were well-trained officers, they don't have that extra little bit that the person who's a true expert would have, and things can spin out of control. And there's one leverage point where we could probably reduce the number of officer-involved shootings around the country.
Dan Isom, how difficult would it be to establish that kind of a procedure?
Well, it's really all about resources and the political will to do it. I mean, many people are in crisis when they call the police, and it's really not about that point in time. It's about follow-up. So if you have a mental health issue, you need caseworkers, you need managers who are going to follow up and make sure that person has the counseling and stays on their medication. If you get a call for domestic violence, yes, they're experiencing a crisis at that point, and you can arrest the person who's responsible. But what about long-term family therapy? You know, a child who is experiencing problems as a incorrigible child or getting involved in mischief or, you know, minor crimes, who's going to follow up and give that child and the family the necessary counseling so they can move forward? So all of these things rest upon the shoulders of officers when they're not resolved, because they become repeat calls for service, whether it's mental health, family issues, all of these things, even rehab facilities, which are sorely underfunded in many communities.
Yeah, this brings me back to where we started, in a sense, because what we're suggesting here is that the police are social workers. I mean, out on the street, they're having to deal with social problems. The program you were on the other day, Dave Klinger, with Ta-Nehisi Coates, he basically said police are being asked to be social workers and deal with social problems.
Yeah, and there is that is appropriate in one regard, and that is in the regard where it's not a crisis and the police can come in and they can manage things and they can assist and they can give referrals, so on and so forth. It's when there is someone who's in an acute state of distress, or as Dan just pointed out, maybe there's a chronic problem where the police don't have the resources to assist that person, not just at the moment, but in the lead up to it and in the follow up. And so I agree with Dan's comment. I agree with what Mr. Coates said yesterday or a couple of days ago, that the police need to be understood as something different than they're currently understood as, because now our society, as I said, just dumps all their problems on the police. We need to figure out a better model where the police are obviously in the community, the police are doing their best, the police are trying to resolve those issues that they can, but where there's expertise, bring in the experts. I mean, one of the things that we know when we have a gunshot victim or someone has another type of medical crisis, the cops don't provide the first aid and put the person on the ambulance. It's the EMTs who have that. Now, the police can do some aspects of first aid, but they're not the experts. We call the experts. We should do the same thing for other types of problems.
Dan Isom, you mentioned a couple of moments ago that it's a question of political will to cause some of these things to change and be fixed, perhaps. Chief Brown yesterday, during his comments at the memorial service, says lawmakers aren't doing enough.
Yeah, I think it's time to really reexamine not only what we do to help people who are in crisis, but people who are in poor communities to deal with some of their issues, but also how much resources do we need to put into policing to be able to achieve a more a safer community. The other thing is that, you know, oftentimes we don't have enough officers in these communities to deal with these issues. We don't spend enough time and money in training officers. whether it be in the academy, continuing education training. All of these things need to be examined so that we have, you know, the necessary resources to so that people have a better quality of life.
Do you have the feeling, given all that's gone on in the last week, that things are going to change? I mean, is this going to affect any kind of change, the drama of the past week?
Well, I do think so. I mean, I've been in a lot of different meetings and discussions about what we need to do moving forward. And, you know, from my perspective is how do we change policing in a way that provides better service? And I think there are some things that can be done on the policing side. I think addressing this issue of deadly force in a way where we research how officers are using force, research how you can de-escalate situations in a way where you give both the officer and the citizens more time to make good decisions is something that I think could reduce the number of shootings. But I also think that police departments can move to more independent investigations and prosecutions so that when the decision is made, people have better trust and confidence in the outcome, no matter what it might be.
What do you think, Dave Clear?
I agree about 92%. The place where I disagree with Dan in terms of having maybe independent investigations, I always say, and I've been arguing for years, and Dan knows this for the last 10 or 15 years, that you need to have independent review of the officer-involved shooting. So the department doesn't an administrative review, but there is an independent criminal review. But the investigation should be handled by the best investigators in the area. And so here, for example, in St. Louis, they have the Force Investigation Unit that's been stood up in the last few years. And this group of officers gets a lot of good training about the best ways to investigate officer-involved shootings, conduct interviews, get all the physical evidence, put it together, all that kind of stuff. And what I wouldn't want to see is I wouldn't want to see a less expert group from the outside come in and do the investigations, because Lieutenant Engelhardt and his crew are really good at doing these investigations. And so I think the key thing is that the community understand that the investigation has integrity. And so as long as the community is informed of what's going on and the community can look at the investigation and go, yeah, they left no stone unturned, that should be the way to do it. What Dan's suggesting in terms of an outside entity, I'm not against that per se, but those guys darn well and those gals darn well better have the same level of expertise as the guys and gals that have done this for years have.
I've got to take a break. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. With me in studio are Professors Dan Isom and Dave Klinger from the Criminology Department at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We'll continue our discussion on today's policing in view of the incidents, publicized incidents, obviously, of last week. We'll do that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on today's policing with Dan Isom and Dave Klinger of the Criminology Department of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Do you think, gentlemen, that the onus has been placed on police officers throughout all of this? I refer to a cartoon that was in the Post-Dispatch last week. It showed a police officer in a pharmacy asking the pharmacist, "What have you got for an itchy trigger finger?" It seems to me that that's, you know, the kind of way people may be thinking today. Dave, you want to react to that?
Yeah. I don't know who the cartoonist is, and good for him or her for being completely ignorant about the nature of the use of deadly force. And the reason I say that is that I've interviewed about 300 police officers around the country who've been involved in shootings. And almost invariably, they have been involved in other situations where they had lawful warrant without a doubt to shoot, and they held their fire. And so the great untold story of American policing is how restrained police officers are. And we forget that police officers interact with people around the country literally millions of times a year and are involved in some thousands of shootings. We don't know how many thousands because we don't have good data. I don't want to get too far down that road. But suffice it to say that as we get good data, what we find is that the majority, the vast majority of times that officers could shoot, they don't. And that needs to be told. And I don't want to promote my book too much, but everybody should grab a copy of my book and read Chapter 3, story after story after story of situations where officers have been shot at and didn't return fire. One case, an officer actually shot and didn't return fire. People having guns, pointing guns, grabbing for guns, attacking them with all sorts of things. And officers manage the vast majority of the time to figure a way out without shooting, because cops don't want to shoot people.
And most of the time don't.
Absolutely.
And most cops never fire the service weapon at all during an entire career. What do you think, Dan Otteson?
Well, you know, I think this question has been raised quite a few times. Whose responsibility is it to bridge this divide? And of course, it's a dual responsibility. But I think as professionals, as people who are public servants, police officers have the first responsibility. And so when I think about policing right now, how do we make what we do more transparent, get people to better understand the job of a police officer? And how do we build greater trust? Now, we do expect citizens to trust and respect officers and to cooperate when they encounter officers. The system works a lot better when that occurs. But we also must recognize that some people won't. And so we have to train officers in the best way to be able to deal with those confrontational situations. And so it's a partnership to make your community better. But I think it starts with the police. And so the police departments and police officers need to find a way to communicate what Dave has just talked about. What is the real nature of police work? What are we trying to accomplish? And how are we teaching and training our officers? All of this is very important. And then the other thing I think with all of these incidents is that police departments really need to be wrapped into social media and what is trending and get in front of that with counter information before things spiral out of control.
You know, as you indicated earlier, Dan, we've had these conversations before, and you've said essentially the same thing in many of the conversations that we've had.
Yes.
But things don't change.
Well, it's a process. Change is difficult. I mean, I think we take sort of baby steps towards progress. I will say in all my conversations with police chiefs, police officers, the police profession understands we're in a different era and a different time. And this is to one of my points. I don't think the profession is transparent enough about what they're attempting to do to make changes. Mm-hmm. And they need to do a better job of that, because I hear a lot of changes being made within police departments, but you don't necessarily hear it in public. Mm-hmm. And so maybe police departments need to open up their doors and not be so secretive about what they're trying to do.
A good example of that is on the East Coast in 1971, NYPD officers killed 93 citizens, is my best recollection. Nowadays, they kill 9 or 10 a year. So they have had a ridiculous decrease in the number of people they kill. But for some reason, people don't understand how remarkably restrained the NYPD is. And that's just one agency, you know, historically over the last 40-plus years. And what Dan is talking about in terms of getting the message out, I agree with him, but I also feel as if the goalposts have been moved. Because we have, as a profession, law enforcement, has remarkably reduced the amount of times that they shoot people, but it's still a perennial problem. And so for me, the answer to why it's a perennial problem has not much to do with race, but has to do with the nature of the American culture. And we have always been a culture that is very jealous of our individual rights, and we don't want the police in our business. And so when American police agencies were first formed on the East Coast, and then starting a little bit later in the Midwest, in the mid-decades of the 1800s, there was pushback. People didn't want the cops. Go back to Great Britain, where the London Met was founded in 1829. There was a huge outcry against that, and it took a long time to get a police department stood up over there. And so if we think about this, part of the problem is no matter what the police do, the fact that they are an entity of government in the community enforcing rules is something that goes against the American grain.
Well, let's take a couple of calls as time will allow, and we'll start with Sheila, who's calling from St. Louis. Sheila, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
My question is, what happened to when a police officer says stop or raise your hands up, that the people don't listen? Now, listen, I'm white, and I've had so many problems with police over the years with corruption. It cost me several thousand dollars from a police officer one time who absolutely lied, and it was over a little puppy of mine. But anyway, it cost me a fortune, so I know about dishonesty and corruption. But what happened in Ferguson, and why is St. Louis getting such bad press? That young man should have put his hands up.
All right, Sheila, we get the point, and we'll address that. Compliance, it's really necessary if you want to avoid incidents.
Well, I mean, we do expect and we teach our children to comply with the authority of police officers. But simply because a person doesn't comply doesn't allow for a police officer to handle that situation any way he feels appropriate. There are professional and legal requirements in terms of what type of force you can use. And so I think one of the things we say, you know, in the policing profession, if we could critique some of those things, is that sometimes officers don't use the proper protocols that we have taught them in the police academy to de-escalate or manage those situations in a way that they can come to a successful conclusion. Now, we all understand if somebody pulls a weapon and points it at an officer, there's no time for talking and discussion. The officer has to respond. But in some of these situations, the luxury of having more time and putting more distance between the suspect, using cover, calling for backup, could tend to have a different outcome in these situations. So, yes, we hope that everyone complies with the police, and we have that expectation. But if they don't, then there are ways in which we have taught officers to deal with those situations that are appropriate.
Dave Klinger, after Dallas, would you anticipate that officers are likely to be, some officers, likely to be a little more jittery, if you will, and be quick to take action maybe they shouldn't?
Jittery but quick to take action they shouldn't, I don't believe so. And let me just tell you a quick story. There were two police officers who were murdered in San Diego. They were ambushed at a call of a neighbor dispute, and I was 100 miles up the road in Los Angeles when this happened. And for a while there, the way that my colleagues were responding to dispute calls in the neighborhood was much more cautious, and they wouldn't approach buildings, and they would set up across the street, and they would try to figure out ways to not engage people at all. The problem is that you have to engage people. And so we figured out a way within a week or so to get our bearings back. And so for my money, the jitteriness actually would tend to lead to more restraint rather than less restraint. Now, that doesn't mean that there might be some officers out there who might inappropriately feel more vulnerable and make the wrong decision. But I'm just talking about my own experience, and I've got friends on the Dallas Police Department, and they're out there doing their job today just like they did last week before their colleagues were murdered.
Dan Eisen, want to weigh in on that, the jittery quotient?
Well, I think, in terms of being a police officer, there's always this sense that you may experience some violence while you're on the job. And so you need to be prepared for that. In this day and age, with what's happening, I'm sure that there's a lot of tension that officers are experiencing now, but it shouldn't change the way that they respond to situations, and it should be based on the situations that confront them on a day-to-day basis. And I hope and I'm pretty sure that that's the way most officers are dealing with the situation.
Let's take another call. We'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I don't think there's any of us in any profession that haven't worked alongside someone and thought, if not outright, that, you know, this person really isn't cut out for this line of work. And I know from my background in aviation, pilots are merciless on their criticism of any of their fellow pilots that they feel made a questionable decision. And I think a lot of, we confront what's, I guess, sometimes termed the blue wall of silence. But on the other hand, I don't think the average person understands not only how complicated just an average police officer's day is and how many different skills are brought into play just to navigate through the difficulties that they face. But over the past 35 years, we have been increasingly become a country of haves and have-nots. and also the most armed country in the world. And I think police officers are confronted with having to manage problems that they had no part in the making of, and it's almost as if they are. It's an almost impossible task.
Let's get a response, Jerry. Jerry, time's getting away from us. Thank you for the comment. That kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the social aspect of it.
One of the things that's interesting is he talks about aviation, and aviation is remarkably safe. And one of the reasons aviation is remarkably safe is because there are demands both within the pilot community and the oversight communities that pilots do everything well. And that's actually a model for how policing could get better. One of the things that pilots do is they have the ability to anonymously and confidentially talk about near misses, situations that almost went bad but didn't. And the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C., a group I'm affiliated with, and Dan is sometimes too, they've put together a near miss collection process for law enforcement, and hopefully we'll be able to learn from that. And part of the model that built this system is the aviation community.
You know, if I could say one thing that I would do today based on what the caller is saying is open up the doors to the police department. Let Black Lives Matter come in and see the training that is going on in the police academy. Let them ride along as monitors in the police car. I just hosted some training at the university. 100 officers went to Valor training. It was officer safety training. Citizens should have been in that room at the time. I think sometimes we believe the things that we're hearing, that we are trained, are top secret. They're not top secret. A lot of them are common sense measures. And people being involved and seeing not only what officers go through, but the expectations that we have for officers are extremely high. And so we need people to see, hear, and be a part of what police officers are doing. So not only they understand, but also they can monitor what's happening.
It was interesting what Chief Brown said yesterday in Dallas during the service. He said, step off the protest line and step into the job application line here at the police department. We have openings. Fill out an application.
Well, change can come from the outside, but permanent change comes from the inside. And so we need people who are very concerned about this to be a part of the process of change and part of understanding what police officers go through, but also helping them make the profession better.
Okay, let's take one more call, and we'll bring in Ron calling from Ferguson. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to ask a question. There was a professor that was on CNN during the Mike Brown killing, and the commentator asked that police officer, I believe it's your guest, shouldn't there be more Black police officers in Ferguson since there was only 3 out of 53? And he said, yes, if they were competent, which would to me would indicate that the only reason that we don't have more in Ferguson because they're not competent. But when I look at a lot of these shootings, and I think 99.9% of the police officers do a great job in that small number. But if you look at Tamir Rice, where they pulled up in front of him within seconds, jumped out and shot him, that's incompetence. But nobody refers to these police officers that are white that are doing these crazy shootings as incompetent.
Could I challenge you, sir?
Hasn't done anything is labeled incompetent or is assumed to be incompetent. That's why the numbers are there's a disparity in the numbers. Just in Ferguson, we should have almost 36 Black police officers, and we only got 3. So okay. That's a disparity in employment. And there's a psychological effect when you live in a community and everybody that has a gun and authority lives outside of that community and don't pay taxes there. So it's almost like a police state. So
Ron, I got to stop you there, Ron. Time is a waste, and Dave wants to respond.
Yeah, two things. First of all, I have said in multiple media presentations that the officers in Cleveland were exceptionally incompetent. I was actually talking to Kimberly Kindy from the Washington Post about that very issue this morning. I've actually written in my testimony to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights that those officers were incompetent. So, yes, I have called out white police officers for incompetence. Regarding my comment about Ferguson and the police department, I wasn't saying that Black people aren't competent to be police officers. I'm sitting right next to an officer, former officer, who happens to be Black. What I was saying was what Ferguson needs is competent police officers. If all of the officers in Ferguson were great police officers, it wouldn't matter what color they were. That was my point, is people deserve the best police officers, irrespective of their color.
Very quickly, let me ask you, Dan Isom, do black police officers and white police officers see what's going on today the same way?
I mean, surely they don't. I mean, they see it through a professional lens the same way, but all different races and ethnic groups come to the profession with their own histories and backgrounds. And so it's a complex mix of understanding the situation where you may have lived an experience, but now you're in the profession. And so I think for African-American officers, oftentimes they don't see themselves as the problem. They see themselves as trying to make the community better, make the community safe. But they also recognize and understand some of the historical significance of what's happened between police officers. So it's a complex mix of feelings that I think that African-American officers have.
I know you've got a class to teach and need to go, but I have to a very quick question to each of you. Kathleen Parker in The Washington Post said today, we have reached a tipping point in the social justice world. Very quickly, have we?
I don't know that we have, but I hope that we are able to stop talking past each other and start to come to some resolution to some of these deeply entrenched problems that we have. We can't take much more of these incidents and the community frustration.
Right. Very quickly, Dave Clare.
I hope that we're not on the precipice of something bad, because when I came into law enforcement 30-some years ago, the guys that trained me went through the late 60s and 70s where officers were getting murdered at a much higher rate than they are today. Levels of violent crime are starting to spiral out of control. I hope that we're not there again.
I want to thank you both, Professors Dan Isom and also Dave Klinger from UMSL's Criminology Department, for being with us. Up next, strengthening diversity, one relationship at a time. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.